Welcome again to another edition of the Horsing Around podcast as we have another busy NFL week already under the belt, but also a busy NFL weekend and then week next week ahead of us as the owners' meetings get going. I'm Andy Lindahl, your Broncos sideline reporter for KOA News Radio, 850 AM and 94.1 FM, along here with the man, the myth, the legend of DenverBroncos.com, of course, Andrew Mason. Bunch to get to, Andrew. Let's get right to it.
I've told you this before. I still feel this way now. I just feel like this Romo thing is starting to become more of a hope than something that is really solid. When we started free agency and there was rumors he was going to be released, not even rumors, reports from Adam Schefter, the best guy in the business, that he was going to be released the Thursday the free agency opened, I thought, okay, this is realistically something. A matter of fact, not only realistically, I thought he might be the Broncos quarterback by that following Sunday. When he never got released and this thing's continued to drag on, and I think now there's some suggestions out there. I know I've heard him anyway from people that I trust that he prefers actually Houston to Denver. I've just kind of passed on Tony Romo being the quarterback here anymore. You and I have talked about it, and I think even earlier in the week, that, hey, look, they're fine with the young guys, whether the fans want to hear that statement coming from UCL Training Center or not. But now I'm seeing the tweets as we get towards the weekend where, oh, Tony Romo may be released. Oh, something's going to happen at the owners' meetings. Where do you stand in all this now?
Well, if you're the Cowboys, they still hold all the cards in this, and that's why they've been able to hold on to Tony Romo for the last 2 weeks since the start of the league year, since the reports that you mentioned. So ultimately, it's up to them. They fit him under the cap. I mean, I would say if nothing happens in the next several days at the league meetings, then you're probably talking about post June 1 when you can divide the cap hit over 2 years. That's when I could see something happening if nothing comes to pass within the next week or so, because you know you've got all the owners, all the GMs, all the coaches, they're all in the same rooms together. Sometimes the groundwork does get laid for things, and sometimes that becomes an impetus to make a move one way or another on a situation like this, which is exceptionally rare, of course.
So, help me out with this, though, Andrew, because from what we've been told, the Broncos, and I believe this, the Broncos are not trading for Tony Romo. They're not taking on that contract.
No.
We've said all along on the podcast and on the air, it has to be a signing of convenience. I cannot drive that statement home enough. To me, the Texans, it sounds like, after trading Brock Osweiler, in my mind, they appear to be willing to go all in. So that's what I mean. By convenience, it means the right money for the Broncos, and frankly, what would be a deal, I would believe, for the franchise. They're not looking to break the bank and give you your highest offer and so on and so forth. You have to be released with no attachments to this thing, which allows them to make that contract on their terms and not pick up a deal that you already have in place, whereas the Texans maybe are more willing to take on at least the money. They've said they don't want to trade for it either. So why at the owners' meetings would that get things loosened up when we're not talking about a trade likely coming together?
It's just a demarcation point. It's just you never know what kind of discussions happen. I mean, obviously, you know, teams can't talk about Tony Romo publicly. I mean, that's why you don't hear anything from any team that could be interested, because they can't. You simply can't do that. But what if the Cowboys and their people bring up some possibilities, then sometimes the ball gets moving because of that.
What would you put your percentage then at that Tony Romo is a Bronco now, that we're this far into the process and there's been no movement? Has it gone down since the start of free agency?
I don't think it's gone up or down since the start of free agency. I don't think it's been affected at all. I mean, I've been lukewarm on the chances of it happening realistically. I'd still say it's somewhere in the 20 to 30% range.
So you never really thought it was all that likely to begin with?
No.
So, okay. Well, with that being said then, we had talked earlier about how Bronco fans, you didn't know what was happening when you were suffering through that bad 2010 season. But really, so many things that happened during that 2010 season, from Josh McDaniels being gone, the man who traded away Jay Cutler, and basically created a void at quarterback that you needed to fill, one of those all-cost kind of need to fill at all-cost voids, which I don't think the Broncos are in right now. That's just always been my opinion. I like Trevor Siemian, and I think it's way too early to write off Paxton Lynch. And Andrew told us just beginning of the week why you shouldn't write off Paxton Lynch. And if you don't believe me, you want the further reasons, go read Andrew's article on DenverBroncos.com as you sat down with Paxton.
And with Trevor, don't forget, I mean, players get better.
Right.
They can and do get better with more experience. So why wouldn't he get better with more time?
Well, nobody wants to, I guess, consider that possibility. That's been the interesting thing to me about this offseason, the narrative about it. But at what point do you think Bronco fans accept that at some point you may have to spend a season with a young quarterback in order to get the long-term success like you've had in the past as well? Because as you and I have said, you went through that season of suffering in 2010, but it got you Von Miller, and it started the wheels turning in the right direction. And not really just Von Miller, but some other quality pieces, and really a number of quality drafts kind of moved from there.
Maybe you just had that season.
Okay, then.
That's a possibility that made that the 9-7 season with a great defense and a struggling offense with young quarterbacks, maybe that was the year.
Wow, if 9-7 is the struggling season, then you're doing all right. You know, because what was it, 6-10? Was it 6-10?
6-10 in 1999 after Elway, yep.
What was 2010?
4-12.
4-12. Oh, I forgot just how bad that was.
That team had a horrendous defense. You go 9-7 with that defense, that great defense, then some people will say, well, you wasted the year. But if that defense, and defenses often have, you know, great defenses can have a 4-6 year lifespan. So if that's the case, the Broncos should have some more good years coming from this defense. And if it is Trevor Siemian or Paxton Lynch, if they can take some steps forward, then maybe you're in good shape this year. We'll see.
Well, look, and Bill just wrote us. Bill, we're happy you're listening. You got to get off your Tony Romo fetish. Every time I tune in, you're talking about him. Billy, I got news for you. I'm not the guy telling you that he's coming here, but I am trying to keep an even. Andrew's here, a guy whose opinion I trust inside the building. I'm just trying to give everybody realistic opportunities to take in what may happen with him. Because the new round of tweets are coming, that now the owners' meetings are coming, and that's going to break everything loose. And I can see all of the, at least, social media news cycle veering towards, hey, the Broncos are on the Tony Romo path again. I'm just trying to keep it in perspective for Bronco fans, just like last year when I tried to tell you that Colin Kaepernick likely wasn't coming here, despite everything to the contrary of that, that don't be getting your hopes up too high for this right now, because it's gone down too much. And I'm just trying to reiterate, because Bronco fans, I heard from them last year, you guys got my hopes up that such and such was happening, and it didn't. So this is your splash reality. Since this is a team that doesn't want to trade for him, don't think that the owners' meetings is somehow going to break everything free. Now, I may be wrong, because you never know what John Elway is going to do. But right now, don't count on this happening just because the owners' meetings are shooting. What happens at owners' meetings are trades. And I'll go back to the Jay Cutler situation. Remember, Jay Cutler, the stuff started happening at the owners' meetings because that's when actually the owners and the GMs and the decision makers got in the same room and started talking because they had time.
And this is also the point where you start seeing a lot of draft picks involved in deals as well. When deals are made, some of it is setting up to the draft. Teams have got a better feel for the board, their needs, and they start saying, and that's where you start seeing some movement up and down as teams start saying, oh, I might need to move up or move down and get that guy and players involved. So there's a lot of that can begin. And it's not just the owners getting together, but the general managers all getting together for meetings. That's a key part of it. Coaches, owners, general managers, all together, things often happen.
All right. So with that being the case, you started talking about needing to move up and move down. You know, one of the guys that I'd love to see the Broncos get, and yesterday, boy, seeing the reaction to the pro day as well for Christian McCaffrey, I'd love to see the Broncos add a Christian McCaffrey. They're sitting at 20th. What do you think yesterday's pro day did? Because all I keep seeing now from people that matter around the NFL is it's amazing how this guy runs routes as well as, and the NFL's starting to figure out, or maybe I shouldn't even say the NFL, maybe it's the general scouts out there that are doing some of the tweeting and more active on social media. They seem to be figuring out, hey, this is a 200-pound back that can run between the tackles. This isn't some 160-pound scat back that you're not going to go and give him the ball between the tackles. I think Christian's versatility between the combine and now his pro day has really been on display. Where do you think he ends up falling? How hard a pick do you think that's going to be for Broncos, or do you think he's still going to be there at 20 now?
I think there's a chance he's there at 20, although when I did the mock draft this past week, I almost had him going to the Saints at number 11, and I think that's what the range for Christian McCaffrey probably starts around 10 to 11 and goes right on down to 32 at the end of the first round. So, you know, the Broncos picking 20, they're right in the heart of that, and certainly they could move up if he's the guy they want and they target him. That being said, they have moved up in the 20s, you know, back in 20 of in when you had Shane Ray in 2014, when you had or 2015, pardon me, and when you had the Paxton Lynch deal last year. So they have done some moving up over the last couple of years, but the thing is, it costs more to move up in the teams than it does in the 20s, so the price would be a little bit steeper. And is that one the Broncos would want to pay if they want to move up five slots? But sir, if that's what it took. The thing with McCaffrey, everyone's going crazy about him doing receiver drills yesterday, but he did receiver drills at the combine too.
Right.
So I was asked yesterday, what did McCaffrey show? And I said, you know, I don't think he showed anything that wasn't already there. I think it may have just kind of been the period and the exclamation point on his case, but I think everything he showed, it was already there in the combine workout, and it was certainly already there in great abundance from the film that he put up at Stanford.
See, when you talk about jumping up that many spots to go from 20 to, I think 20 to 15 maybe is doable, maybe even 14. If you're talking about beating the Saints and having get to 10, that's a lot of draft capital all of a sudden, isn't it?
Yeah, and now, that being said, I had a quarterback mock to the Saints at number 11. I mean, they may well be zeroing in on these quarterbacks. There's a lot of buzz about how much they like Patrick Mahomes in particular out of Texas Tech. And I think if you were trying to think of a quarterback in terms of skill set that could eventually replace Drew Brees with minimal disruption to the offense, a guy with a quick delivery and quick reads of the defense like Mahomes is, could be that guy. So they may well be looking long and hard at him. But there's a lot of possibilities for McCaffrey in the teens. I think Philadelphia at 14 is certainly one. I could see Washington, which their receiving core has taken some hits. I could see Washington being in play for him. Tennessee at 18, you know, 18. It's funny because I talk about Christian McCaffrey and I look at receiver cores as well, because not only is he a running back, but I see him as someone that can plug in the slot and plug in outside. That's why. So you're considering more. You're not just considering a running back need. You're considering receiver needs with Christian McCaffrey. That's why I think Philadelphia will look at him. That's why I think Washington will look at him. That's why I think Tennessee, which is an offense that really needs some explosion, could look at him. But you think of offenses that need explosion, you look at the Broncos. They had 44 plays of 20 or more yards last year, dead last in the league, tied with Houston.
Help me out then with other difference makers in the middle of the field. Because right now, whether that's McCaffrey, who can go slot, who can go in the backfield, whether it's O.J. Howard, the tight end, give me other guys that you could look at. Because to me, as I talk to some of the guys that I trust, middle of the field kind of playmaking ability is where this team needs something. Now, maybe A.J. Derby turns into something. Maybe Jeff Hierman shows us something different. But right now, it's unfair because we're telling everybody not to assume, right? Trevor Siemian and Paxton Lynch are coming back on the same plane. But if you wanted to add more competition for middle of the field explosion outside of McCaffrey, who are you talking about?
Talking about the tight ends, I love Bucky Hodges out of Virginia Tech. And he's a 257-pound guy that can run a 4.5, 7.40. And he's nimble enough and fast enough to where he can be used on the outside, but he's big enough to where he can go inside as well. Now, O.J. Howard is the best blend of all the tight ends. There's a reason why he's number one, because he has the pass-catching skills, but he has the willingness to be a good blocker and the body type to be a good blocker. He's not a 234-pound guy like an Evan Engram out of Mississippi, who I think is going to end up in the second round, but he can create some mismatches. But as far as the guy that can go everywhere, I look at Bucky Hodges, and maybe he's there in round two as another kind of chess piece type weapon that you can move around the board situationally and can cause a lot of problems. You know, sometimes I'll sit there and I'll look at the offense and I'll daydream a little bit about the possibilities for the Broncos. And a couple of days ago, I was sitting there thinking, Boy, if you had Christian McCaffrey and Bucky Hodges out there, guys you can move around to go along with what you already have in, you know, in, with C.J. Anderson and Demaryius Thomas and Emmanuel Sanders, et cetera, you could have something really extraordinary out there.
Well, and then it becomes a more potent offense that has problems everywhere, not just on the outside with your two receivers. Again, as you've now had a week to think about it, where do you think they go for left tackle help? Are you starting to feel like maybe more the left tackle that is going to start at least the opener is already on the roster, or do you think they're still looking for someone to add for that position?
I think it's possible that it could be on the roster, but I also think that they're still looking. I think a pretty instructive example is if you go back to 2013. Going into that draft, there was a pretty clear need for kind of a complementary edge after Elvis Dumervil and all the fact stuff happened, and he was no longer with the team. So you go into the draft with that need, and there were some guys that kind of filled that role potentially, but the Broncos decided to pick Sylvester Williams, an inside guy, a 4-3 D-tackle, ran the 4-3 at the time. So very soon after that, Sean Phillips, who'd still been on the market, was brought in for a visit and was agreeing to terms before even the draft was over. He was, I remember on the third day of the draft, we were doing the conference call with Sean Phillips. They made that move after the first round had passed, and they'd not gotten that immediate plug-in edge rusher. And Sean Phillips had a pretty good year for the Broncos back in 2013. So, and don't forget last year, to fill some roster voids before the draft, they signed some players just to kind of make sure that they were covered no matter what. So you had that draft flexibility. So it wouldn't surprise me if sometime before the draft, or maybe they wait and they do it immediately after, there's a veteran left tackle brought in.
You'd have to think that they would want a little more veteran competition in there somewhere. Now, the thing is that you've got to figure out, who fits the mold and who's really still out there and so on and so forth. But, you know, do you think it's possible? Do you think it's possible that they fix all the problems that they need to fix in this offseason? Or is it just going to be another one where you try to get by at, say, the left tackle that we're talking about?
Well, are you talking about fixing for the long term?
How about fixing successful enough to make that playoff run?
Oh, I think you can take care of left tackle like that. And I actually think there are some better prospects when you get into rounds 2 and 3 that may have higher ceilings but aren't ready. The guy I kind of fixate on and I've watched a lot of is Antonio Garcia out of Troy. And aside from the weight, you'd like him to put on a little more. He played at 280. He's actually up around 300 now. He was at 290 or so around at the Senior Bowl. So he's putting on weight, but he seems to be handling it well. So you probably got to get him in the weight room a bit more. And he certainly needs a lot of technical refinement. But as far as the measurables go, as far as the ability to guide a pass rusher outside to take that guy off the edge, push him out and behind the quarterback so to where he's not causing any disruption and not coming into the pocket, Antonio Garcia is very good at that. There's a lot in his game that needs some tweaking, but he might have a higher ceiling than any of these first-round tackles we're talking about. It's just that he wouldn't be ready this year, so you would need a one-year solution at left tackle.
How often are we going to find, when it comes to these kids that we draft, that the left tackle position starts to mirror the quarterback position, where you may not get as many game-ready Ryan Clady's, Orlando Pace's, guys like that? Is that a thing of the past? Are you going to have to start getting ready to groom your offensive linemen more than you have in the past?
Absolutely. And it's something that I know that our friend Jeff Legwold has discussed. It's the gap between college and pro football, and that it's almost two different sports at this point, especially in terms of what the tackles are being asked to do, that it's going to be more projection. And it may take some time. It may be a 4 to 5 year process before you've really got that tackle ready to go. I think of like a Menelik Watson, for instance. Athletically has all the tools, checks all the boxes. But he came to football late, 2011. And then when he got to the Raiders in 2013, began battling injuries. So he's missed practice time and game time. that he needed in order to get better. The Broncos are thinking that with better health, he can get more reps on the practice field, and that maybe he's going to be a good tackle for them, and that if Menelik Watson works out, I think you may see teams in free agency target those guys that have upside, that have experience but still need some teaching, knowing that the development of an offensive lineman, particularly a tackle on the left or right side, could be a process that takes 4 to 6 years to get right.
Well, and so what you're telling me, this is a little off of what the NBA deals with now because they let so many kids in so young, but you're getting players, especially at this offensive line and quarterback position, that still need a lot of the fundamental coaching.
Yeah.
More than, I mean, in the past, as it's been explained to me, it was about understanding the pro game and the pro ball. Now you're having to teach people proper technique and fundamentals that maybe they don't come to you with from college.
Yeah, that's the big thing. And part of it is that they simply don't have to learn. And like, take quarterbacks, for instance. A quarterback doesn't really have to learn how to call a play in the huddle anymore, depending on the scheme he's in. Because everyone just looks at the sideline and sees the big poster board with pop culture references. Darth Vader's in the bottom left corner. So we're going to go off right tackle, you know, I guess. And that's why Paxton Lynch, for example, has talked about how he had to learn how to relay the play calls. And that was difficult because he didn't have to do that at Memphis. But, you know, the tackles, you know, how often are you seeing hand in the dirt tackles in the college level?
You don't anymore.
Not exactly.
They're all in shotgun, ready to pass protect stances.
Yeah. So you've got to teach him how to operate with his hand in the dirt. That's a big transition for a lot of these guys.
Well, these are the little things that we talk about, again, as you get ready, and I'm looking at mock drafts, and mock drafts have the Broncos taking a tackle with their first pick, which ultimately may happen. The one I just saw from Bucky Brooks says Garrett Bowles, a kid out of Utah, which...
I know that there's a lot of fondness in league circles and team and a lot of teams for his attitude, and he certainly brings that nasty kind of attitude. And you look at some of the guys the Broncos have brought in, and Garrett Bowles would probably fit that template in terms of the attitude.
And so we're not saying that it doesn't fit, but if you do get Garrett Bowles, just like Paxton Lynch last year, you can't assume this is put him in and he's your starter, right? Because I've not heard that there's a starter really available in this draft. Is there?
I mean, Cam Robinson coming from Alabama, one of the few offenses that's relatively analogous to what you'll see in the NFL, he may be a bit ahead, but I'm not sure that his upside is all that high.
He may have plateaued already.
Yeah, I mean,
you're getting is what you're getting.
Right. I mean, that's, of course, there were some people who thought that about Amari Cooper coming out of Alabama, and, you know, I disagreed with that, and certainly he's, you know, proven to be that he's much more than he was at Alabama, which was substantial at Alabama, certainly. So Ryan Ramczyk out of Wisconsin, he's another guy that comes from out of a relatively pro-style scheme. Big thing with Ryan Ramczyk is he's got the hip issue that he's dealing with, and he and Garrett Bowles both only had one level of FBS power conference level starting experience.
Which is always a red flag for NFL teams for the first round, correct?
Yes, and especially at a position like that. That's actually one red flag on Mitchell Trubisky out of North Carolina, the quarterback. Not enough starts because he didn't become the starter at Carolina until this past season.
And we've seen sometimes one-year starters. Wasn't Kyle Bowler a one-year starter?
I believe so, yeah.
You just got to be careful about that because, again, you haven't seen enough of a body work. It's a reason why I've said, back to the Romo thing for my buddy Billy, who is going to be really excited about that, why the Cowboys may actually hold on to him is because you've only got 1 year of starting. You've only got 1 year of tape on him, and you have to see how everybody adjusts. That's why with Trubisky, it would have been curious to see what another year in that league would have done. You know, what would have happened? How would the defensive had adjusted and how would he have handled it? A lot of NFL rules changes are being proposed. What would you say for next week for folks as they start to look at what could go through, what might go through? I mean, we've already had Roger Goodell on Mike and Mike talking about the replay changes and they want to speed up pace of play. They certainly want to keep things moving for those inside the stadium. But honestly, what really do you think will go through and what is just kind of chatter right now. It sounds like the replay thing's all but done. Roger must know he's got the votes for replay, right?
Moving replay to a centralized location and then having the referee on site use a tablet with a headset, that appears a near certainty to pass because they want to streamline the process. They feel like frankly, they've seen it with the NHL and they've seen it with Major League Baseball in particular, that the centralized system can work. The one thing you're always concerned about is if what happens if you get three or four calls that go to New York at the same time. That's the only... There's been a couple of baseball games where there's been a little bit of a delay because all of a sudden a couple of challenges hit at the same time. But if you can handle that flow, that should work. The fact that you're going to have the tablet for the referee and they're going to hand it to him right there on the sideline at the nearest possible spot to where the referee is, so he's not running potentially 75, 80 yards to the replay monitor. That'll help speed up the process a little bit. Another thing, now they're going, if this goes through, they will be able to announce replay rulings during commercial. One of the things that kind of that drove me crazy as someone who's in the stadium is the fact that they would wait until the commercial ended, and then the official would make the announcement. So now, whenever the decision is made, referee's just going to take the mic, say what the decision was, even if people are watching, hardware commercials or beer commercials or whatnot. Besides, just follow people like Andy and myself on Twitter. We'll make sure you know what's going on.
Right, we're
going
to tell you as soon as we find it out. Anyway,
we're not waiting for the end of the break.
What was going on before? So it truly was the referee before then, looking back, because I thought he was getting help from New York, even though he was under the hood.
There was a replay official upstairs who was helping, but ultimately it was coming down to the referee. The referee will still have input, but what they're proposing is that the decision comes from a centralized office in New York.
And Dean Blandino. Yes. He has final say, right?
Yes, he does.
Now, here's the only thing that is going to make this interesting. Mm-hmm. What happens if you have multiple replay challenges happening at once? Because games are going on simultaneously. When does Dean get to your, Let's not.
Or are you saying, okay, he's like ultimately responsible because he's in charge of the department, but you have a referee or two that is, whether it's a current one who's not working a game that week or a retired official, because you've had retired officials that helped out on replays in every market. Do you have those retired officials now go to New York and handle that as well?
I think they're going to need to. You're obviously going to have. Dean won't put his eyes on every call, right?
And having a steady set of eyes like the ones that they have working every game, I think will help that process.
We also look like we're moving towards full-time officials, and I saw a tweet saying, a quote from someone saying, even if they quit, we need to head this direction, even if some would quit, because they're lawyers. And look, even though it's a lot of us would trade our jobs for the salary that these officials make, but a lot of these officials are guys that make very, very nice compensation packages in jobs such as lawyers and well-to-do businessmen and so on and so
jobs
forth.
Jobs where they're running the office.
Yeah.
So they can say, I'm taking this time off. It's tough. The part-time thing has always been difficult because you have to have people that work jobs where they can get that time off, where they have that flexibility. That doesn't really exist. Now you have some like Gene Steratore, he does some teaching, I think, but he also referees college basketball.
Yep. Well,
and I wonder if you have full-time officials that maybe their part-time gigs will be stuff like that they're officiating another sport perhaps.
See, and I like that. Honestly,
to me, it keeps you in practice. I think it's a good thing if you have an NFL official that's refereeing basketball games or soccer games or whatever in the offseason. I think it'd be a positive.
Well, because he's moving and his mind's working quickly, because that's one of the things that you need here. No knock to some of the older guys, but look, you've got to be able to get up and down the field. You've got to be able to get out of the way, and you've got to be able to think and react quickly. And that's why I'm all for, I want the guy that wants to be a lifer at this thing. Mm-hmm. You've got to want to be good. And I'm not saying that any of them necessarily didn't want to be good previously, but when it's not your main form of income, I think it does change anyone's approach. Everyone has a second job that maybe you like a lot, but nonetheless, there's something to be said for, this is how I keep my house, and pay for my car, and get my kids to school. I think you need some of that motivation behind this for some of these guys.
Certainly. And, you know, they've had the option to have some, I believe, 17 full-time officials since 2012. It just hasn't happened yet, but it looks like there's momentum there. You mentioned the color rush thing.
Proposed
by Washington.
You can't wait to get into this, right?
Well, that's not the only proposal that Washington has in regards to bylaws. Interesting. They have three proposals.
They've got a lot to say this offseason.
They always do. Here's one. This is something that Washington puts forth just about every year. Changing how cuts are done. Washington wants to have the cut to 75 taken out, and then there's only one cut at the end of the preseason to 53. In part because that last preseason game, you're mainly playing backups, fringe guys that are fighting for roster spots or guys that won't be on the team. So why not have the full preseason 90-man roster for one more week? So, but they put that forth every year. It hasn't gotten any momentum. I don't know why it would be different at this point.
I could see why the Players Association wouldn't be behind that, because you want guys, if they get cut earlier, they get a chance to get an opportunity, right?
Right. But here's another thing Washington proposed that I think should be passed. If a player has a concussion and is not cleared to play, Washington wants that player to go on the exempt list so he wouldn't count against the roster. And then you'd be allowed to replace him with a player on the practice squad on a game-by-game basis until the player is cleared. And then when the player is cleared, that player from the practice squad would return to the practice squad, and you wouldn't have to expose him to waivers. You wouldn't have to cut him. So you could promote and then put a guy back on the practice squad without risking him on the waiver wire, and you could fill that void that you'd have when a player is not cleared to play through the post-concussion protocol. I really like that proposal. I hope it gets passed.
I am with you. I like that a lot. That makes a lot of sense. It allows you to tweak the roster and not have to worry about keeping a guy up or finding out late that he can't go. I think there's less pressure on a guy to have to, you know, show that he's ready to go until game day, which is important.
And that's the other thing. I think if you have that exempt list that you can put them on until they're cleared, and you could fill that roster spot, I think that there would be a little less pressure to get that guy cleared. I think then you could allow the player to heal and go through the protocol in a less harried manner.
Well, and let's be honest about it, Andrew, if the player's not worried about having to be cut or released or without a job for a week or whatever, hopefully they'll be willing to be a little more honest about how they're feeling, right? I know guys are still trying to maybe not let you know if they're not feeling right or not. Mm-hmm. Unless it's all the way out there. And if a guy knows that, okay, maybe now they don't have to cut me because of this, they have another option as far as being able to, if they have another option as far as knowing that they can keep me around and get me right, I just think that's good for all involved, period. So Brad writes this real quick. Any incentive to make referees have more integrity is well worth it to me. Hire all new officials if you have to. I'm not questioning a lot of officials' integrity. Here's one of the things I will say along Brad's question here, along his tweet, before we run to a quick break, Andrew. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think the refs call the game as they see it best they can. But I have noticed lately, just from my position, I do feel like personal feelings about some of the gripings or arguments maybe being had. I think there has been a little bit of I don't know what else to call it other than an NBA element has kind of snuck in where I'm kind of annoyed with you right now, and I wonder how that influences decision-making at times, especially when coming to a challenged, I can't give you any specific call that I felt like it was maybe influenced, but I can give you times, and there was a couple during John Fox's time here with one referee in particular where I saw the ref wait multiple plays and still going at the coach about certain things where I thought, dude, you got to let that go. We're on from that.
Officials are only human.
Right.
I mean, we see it now. It's not as visible in football as other sports. Like if you watch the NCAA tournament, you watch a lot of college basketball, you see how the coaches can ride the refs and how, you know, sometimes you'll see a reaction. It's funny because a lot of people say that Duke gets the calls with Mike Krzyzewski because he's very vocal and works the refs hard. It's funny, if I were a referee and I was being worked by a Mike Krzyzewski or some other coach, I'd be more likely to make calls against him, his team.
Yep.
But instead, you know, how somehow they quote-unquote get the call. So there's always that human psychological element that's fascinating and can't really be quantified.
How about this? This just came over. I got to go back and figure out the Twitter feed, but basically, let me go see if it was an NFL article. This comes from Jeremy Fowler, who wrote that the NFL buzz from ESPN is, Andrew, that Adrian Peterson is asking for $8 million plus in his first year, and that's why teams have not signed him yet. What do you think the running back needs to do to create a market for himself? Because clearly there isn't one right now.
Take that $8 million and divide it by two.
There you go.
Because Eddie Lacy, much younger, gets a one-year $4.25 million deal from Seattle. Basically, that $8 million for a running back with an injury history and 10 previous seasons, now this will be year 11 for him, he's not going to get that kind of deal, even though he's a big name and even though he's a future Hall of Famer. In, I believe it's 12 running backs in NFL history that changed teams after going over 10,000 yards for their career. And Frank Gore is the only one that had a 1,000-yard season with his new team. We've talked about Tony Dorsett being one of those guys, changed teams back in 88, going from Dallas to Denver.
Short-lived.
Didn't work out. So if you're kind of keeping actuarial tables, as it were, on aging running backs, it's not in his favor, and thus nobody's going to give him a contract like that.
How many teams do you think would then become interested if he were at that $4 million price tag?
Oh, I think half the league.
There you go.
At least. And to the point where he could probably get a little more than that. He could probably get into the $5.5 million range just because there would be a demand for his services. I mean, he's, you know, You roll the dice on someone who's got that kind of performance in teams, and I think teams would be interested in him at least as part of a running back solution. I don't think he's going to be the every down guy for anybody, but I think he could be a starter, and he could share time and share reps and continue his career, but he's got to back down to that demand.
Well, we will see ultimately if Adrian Peterson decides to play for less money. Who knows? If he does, maybe even Denver's interested. All right, for Andrew Mason, I'm Andy Lindahl. Thanks so much for taking time to join us here on the Horse and Round podcast. Another busy week ahead as we have the owners' meetings. We'll wrap up all the proceedings from the owners' meetings and watch for Andrew Mason and the Broncos TV team all week long on DenverBroncos.com as they bring you updates as well. For now, though, we bid you adieu. Have a great weekend and great work week here on DenverBroncos.com.